session number 22114, real one.
Fred Hartle, real one. Where were you born, please?
Born to a place called Dontonbrook, about 2 miles out of centre of Rotherham.
Which year was this?
1917.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Rotherham?
Yes, outside Rotherham, actually. I went to the infant school at Donton. And then we moved from Donton to a place called Sunnyside. And there was no school. So I missed school for about 18 months while they built one. It had to be about 1927-28. There wasn't no school to go to, so. And then 1929 they opened this new school and I went to it for about 18 months.
How old were you when you finished school?
14.
So that must have been in 31.
That's right.
Did you get a job?
Not straight away, we were doing the slump. And there were no work available anywhere at any time then. And at the mine where I was hoping to get some work, they was only on 2 or 3 days a week, and they'd already sacked some of the miners for costs, I suppose, and everybody wants short time. So I didn't start while I'd be about 14 and a half when I started work. And I was sent pony driving down the mine.
What was that like?
Very hard work. And it was dangerous work too. You'd have to turn the pony out. You had to turn the pony out and gear it up, and you took the tubs, as it was called then, up to the miners, the colliers, and they filled them up, and then we took them down onto what they call the main haulage. And then from the main haulage, they were transported and sent out to the shaft to pit top. But it was very hard work.
What were the main dangers?
Main danger was when you're working on an incline, and what they had to do, some of the ponies, they were trained to breach what they call breach the tubs. And the main idea was to put lockers in the wheels to lock them. But sometimes if you miss the lockers, then and you were running a lot down low, you were in bother. And you'd try to outspeed the pony, especially if you couldn't hold them back, you see.
Would the ponies do as you wanted them to? Would the ponies do as you wanted them to?
Yes, they were very good, the ponies. They're very intelligent too. And I can still remember some of the names of them from all them years. Tony was one, they called one Tony. And I'm trying to think of the other names. Monarch was another one. And they were good, really good, these animals that we had down the mine. They were only small, but they knew the job.
Were you fond of them?
Yes. I used to take oranges and grass down the mine to give them to them. Because they never saw anything, only their own food, such as chaff and all like that, was taken down the grain and what have you, down to the pit, you know, down the shaft.
Would they know you as an individual?
Yes, they did know you, yes. And they always looked forward to that little bit of grass, or apple, or anything like that. They looked forward to it. It was something fresh for them, you see.
Were they ever ill-treated?
They worked hard. I won't say they were ill-treated, unless they just started and they had to learn the job So it needed a lot of discipline to make them realise that they had a job to do.
Which pit were you working in?
They called it Silverwood Colliery. It's closed. You might have come past it just now.
Were you ever injured in the pit?
Yes, I went under on the tubs actually, and the pony actually saved me. What happened? You were very low, and I told the man in charge. They called them corporals. They had corporals in the pit besides being in the army, and I told this corporal that. It was too low to put any props and bars on the top of the tub, which was one of the main ways of taking the timber up. Anyway, it took no notice and I set off with it. Well, when I got up to the top to the colliers, I realised that there were a bar missing. And I said to the collier, like, I said, well, give me a start. I've got to go and get that bar out of the way. And it'll be laid across the track. And so they did that. But unfortunately, one of the fillers, he hadn't got very good eyes and he missed the lockers. And those caught up me, knocked me under the first tub. But the bar that had already dropped off and which I wanted to retrieve, it laid across me and it acted as a block and it shoved the first tub up into the roof and of course I was laid under it. So I was shouting out for help then. But they heard me, the man heard me and they couldn't get through, they had to run down a plane and come up from the other side to retrieve me, you see. I was off work about 7 or 8 weeks with that.
How did the pony help you?
Well, he was breached, you see, and he kept still. I was under him, and my head was between both his back legs. And my body was under the first tub. And this had just lifted up into the roof. So if it had started stamping again, excited, it had done my face in, you see. But also, helping to hold the tub's back and assisted by the bar, it saved my life, actually.
Which pony was that?
I called it Tony.
What injuries did you have?
Leg injuries and abrasions. Nothing broke, but I had deep cuts on my legs and my shoulders.
Were you working in this pit when war was declared?
No. The Munich crisis, I decided after the Munich crisis there was going to be a war on. So they'd already started thinking about calling people up. And when I read in the paper that I'd be one of the first to be called up, I decided to go on my own. I decided to join up. It looked imminent that there was going to be a war in the near future. So I decided with another lad who was, he was in the same frame of mind as me. He could see what was likely to happen. So we went up to Sheffield, a place called Surrey Street, and we joined. It was a Scotch lad, this lad, and he wanted to win a Scotch regiment. So I finished up in the Scots Regiment as well. We joined the 1st Battalion. We went to the depot first at Berwick-on-Tweed. And we did our training there.
What was the training like?
Very much the same as what they do now. They looked after us very well. We were recruits. And the training were very strict. And we got some good instructors. And they took us through, and by the time we'd done 6 months, we knew quite a bit about soldiering. And after done the 6 months who were transferred to the 1st Battalion, King's Own Scottish Borders, down stationed down at Portsmouth. When war broke out, which was on the 3rd of September 1939, they immediately mobilised and we did a fortnight's training and then was shipped with a British Expeditionary Force into France. We landed at We were shipped from Southampton and landed in Cherbourg on the Cherbourg Peninsula on the 4th of October 1939.
Which platoon and company were you in?
I was in A Company.
Do you remember the platoon?
Yes, some platoon. I was in 7th Platoon A Company.
What happened once you got to Cherbourg?
Well, when we got off the boat, right, we marched into this here building. It had been it hadn't been used for years, and there were 2 or 3 inches of dust laid about. And when we marched in, we were in for 4 or 5 hours. Until they'd arranged for the trains to be organised to pull us on. Anyway, what happened then was within 4 or 5 hours we came out black. I always remember that, we were black when we came out. Because as we marched in, the dust was rising and got on to all the own equipment. And from there, we were put into cattle trucks. 22 a cattle truck it was, and they put a bale of straw out, and that's what it was, just in these cattle trucks for as old 20. And then we moved out of Cherbourg, and we travelled for about 24 hours, moving, stopping, and only moving very slowly. And then it was taken off the trains, and we stayed at a place called Roussy-Versay. That is still in Normandy. And was there for about 3 or 4 days. After that, we were put back on the into the cattle trucks, and we finished up in northern France at a place called Fretin. Once we got into Fretin, we were put into little farmsteads. All the estaminets would have been closed down. And I think battalion headquarters was probably put in something like the civic hall or something like that. We'd only been there 2 or 3 days and sorting out when we started to dig in. And we were digging fortifications from September. It was quite easy digging until November, and all at once the ground froze, and we found out it was very hard going. We were making very little progress. The ground had got that hard, and we were trying to dig these fortifications in depth and putting barbed wire entanglements up. And when we got topside that job, we decided that the brigadier decided we were going to do some exercises. And we started going back into the Somme area, Arras, and St. Paul's, doing exercises, manoeuvring. But we always seemed to be holding rivers. We never seemed to do any advance work. We were always holding positions or doing a little bit of retiring in organised fashion. On the 10th of May, when Germany attacked the Lowlands, the French, Belgium, Holland, we'd just come off a four-day scheme, actually, around the St. Paul area. And when we arrived back, we'd seen this air activity as we were running back from the manoeuvres into the village of Fetton. And when we got there, somebody had heard on the news that the Germans had broke through to a place called Sedan and were advancing into France and to Belgium. And then what happened was I'd been transferred to the carriers about a month previous as a Bren gunner. And as soon as we got to know that what had happened, the battalion went on what they call stand to, and everybody were put together in companies and platoons and what have you, put into battalion vehicles, 30 hundredweight, 3 tonners and 1500, and we moved to a place called it was a place near Roubaix at a park. And on the night of the 10th, 11th, we moved out of the park at Roubaix in formation, in columns, and proceeded toward Belgium, Belgian border, which was little or no distance away, only a matter of kilometres, a few kilometres away. I went to a place I remember called, I think called it Alost, on his way, and then we started noticing that the first signs of war, some bridges had been attacked in some buildings, and we kept moving east. We came to Brussels. We skirted Brussels, and still travelling east to a place called
I think you remember the name anyway.
Louvain. As we were entering Louvain, we're going down this hill into the town centre, and the university on the right hand side had been hit with bombing, and it was all on fire. I went through, passed through Louvain, still travelling east, and about 6 or 7 miles further east, come to a river Dyle. D-Y-L-E, it's spelt. And there we dug in and waited for the Germans to arrive. A recce, three or four recce vehicles set off to probe where the Germans were, and I think there's only one come back, those have been shot up. So we knew Germans were in the vicinity. The Germans started attacking us on that line, and the battalion gave a good account of itself first time action. And the funny thing is that our first casualty in the battalion was a man called Dyle, D-Y-L-E. And
what were the Germans attacking you with?
Infantry and artillery. When the first, what they call the first airburst, the officer said to me, "Do you know what that is?" I said, "I know it sounds like a shell that's exploded in the air." He said, "It's what they call an airburst." He said, "That's range finding." So he said, "We're probably going to get some ammo." Anyway, we did get a few shells aimed at us, and the infantry battalion were giving quite a good account of themselves. And anyway, the order came then that we got to fall back.
When you were in the line on the River Dyle, were you with the Bren carrier?
I was with the Bren carrier, yes.
Where was that in relation to the...
The infantry were in front of us. The main thing about the cavalry, the vehicles was that they used to cover the withdrawals. They used to let the infantry get away and then rely on their own speed more or less to get out of Allah, you know, because he could move about, oh, like 15 to 20 miles across country.
Is that what you did? Did you cover
the... Yes, we covered the withdrawals, yes. And they were also used for taking ammunition, you know, and all like that.
Were you firing your Bren?
I didn't fire that on the first occasion, no. I think I do remember that. We had to go to aircraft that were flying about, and I think we had to go at it, and, but no chance of hitting it.
Were there many casualties around you?
I had a few. The man Diley were killed, and I think they had several other injuries. Then they had to start dropping back, and we kept dropping back onto different canal systems and rivers.
How did you feel about having to pull out?
Well, we didn't know what was happening. Nobody seemed to know what was happening or the reason why we were trying to move back, because we'd already given a good account of ourselves. And as I said, we kept dropping back, digging in. Then we then started rumours coming through that the French had been taken from the rear at the Maginot Line. These were only rumours, but turned out to be correct. That the French had given way, and the Germans and their armoured columns are already going to the back of the Maginot Line. And now, like, the idea was that was to keep dropping back to straighten the line up. We came back through Brussels, and we did receive, on going into Brussels, we received a very good ovation from the Belgians. But coming back, the streets were deserted, and Brussels had been declared an open city. And we dropped back outside of Brussels again and made some defences, and continually dropping back. There was a bit of fighting and dropping back, and then we started having a lot of problems with the population. They were all on the roads, chock-a-block, and they've got horses and carts, prams, anything on wheels. And they were just blocking the... We just couldn't move about, and just had to go tight. Then the Germans had come down and machine gunned these people. They'd run into the fields on either side. And then as soon as they'd gone, they'd be back on the field, onto the roads again. And they killed quite a few civilians that way. Anyway, we finished up at the place... A place called.
Was it Furness? Furness?
Finesse. It was a place called Finesse. And we made our last stand there. We heard rumours that there's some evacuation going off on the beaches and around Dunkirk, but we weren't quite sure. And then the word come through that. It looked like being every man for himself.
Were you doing much fighting at Furness?
The infantry companies, they were taking they were doing the most fighting. And at Furness, they had all, I think it was about the 1st of June. I think it was about the 1st of June when the battalion had orders to make the way to Dunkirk or on the beaches. And our job, the carriers, at that time, were to string them out and hold the line for 3 hours while the infantry got away. It was the longest 3 hours of my life.
Were you under attack during those 3 hours?
Yeah, they were shelling and all like that. In fact, when we did make a final run after 3 hours, we were heavily shelled, and it seemed, I thought they were our guns that were supporting us, and the shells were falling short. I didn't know that Cali had fell, and they were firing from the Cali side onto us that were retreating, you see.
What did you do with your Bren and Bren carrier?
Well, they hadn't had any service for about 3 weeks now, and the starter motor wouldn't work. So they had a long handle. The motor was situated at the back of the carrier, and it had a long handle. And my job was to, any time he stalled the engine, was to get out, put it in, wind it round, get it going, and then get back into the carrier. What happened then? When we got orders like to get back to Dunkirk, the officer told like, he says, when I move, he says, get moving, because we're on his own now. When we did get the order, we'd only got into carriers and set off. Well, this area, it was covered. All the fields and that were covered with shells, knocked out guns, transport that had been tipped over and printed side of the road and on either side of the road. And it left us very little room. In fact, the driver had to keep switching to knock one end of the vehicle further in so he could get through. When we finally got through and made a run for it, we got moving and they started shelling us from, it must have been from the Cali end. And we got into this village, but just before we got to the village, we saw this engineer, and he was ready to blow the bridge. So the driver got up and just got over the bridge, and his engine stalled. So, with the engine stalled, he knew that they had already lost the long handle. So, he says, has it gone? I said, aye, when he hit that vehicle up the road, back up the road, I says, you knocked it out, done it in. So I says, right, get moving. So we set off.
On foot?
On foot. And it must have been about probably three or 4 mile out of Dunkirk then. And they disappeared because the place was on fire and there were cattle wanted milking and there were telephone wires down. There were hens and chickens all running about, just running about excitedly and horses and just chaos, you know. Anyway, I got walking. I didn't know actually whereabouts I'm going to go. I just thought I'd keep walking, stick to this road. A motorbike come up. They come up to me and he says to me, get moving, Jock. He says, yeah, this is just the right other side of this. He says, we're going to blow up bridge. Well, I heard the bridge go up then. And then a 1,500 weight come. 1,500 weight truck come. And it to steady up, because all the debris that were laid about. And I jumped into this 1,500 weight, there were two or three engineers, like rail engineers. And I got into this truck, and we travelled about 3 mile, I think. And then we couldn't get any further, because of bomb craters and all like that. So we just start walking. And when I got to Dunkirk, the outskirts, the big palace smoke hanging about all over there, and could see all the flames. There was an area that had been flattened, and I could see a bus. So I thought, these people might know where the routes are and whereabouts the front is. So I went up this bus, and when I got up to the bus, I was going to ask them, they were all dead in the bus. They must have been killed by the bombing, you know, and they just stopped there. They must have been killed by a blast. Anyway, I set off again, and I saw a blue jacket, got a steel topi on. So I says to him, what about, so we got to go for this assembly point. He says, go down that corner there, there's a big queue, he says, and there's a long building going out to sea. He says, you'll see a queue there, go and get in there, he says, and you have to take your turn. So I got into this queue, and kept heading forward. He hit it several times, his aircraft coming over and hit it several times. And every time he heard it, they were sending for timber to come and cast over his heads and then cover the gap up, you see, which they didn't, then used to shovel across. And anyway, they kept coming.
Pass the timber.
Oh, yes, and then they'd put it together, you know, and then you'd three or four planks and then you'd edge that way up. Anyway, we did about 7,000 or 8,000, they kept coming over and putting some bombs down. They missed quite a number as well. Anyway, they would have